to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Ashley Betteridge. In this episode, we bring you a recording from our event titled Afghanistan, What Has Been Achieved? This event included the Australian launch of the Asia Foundation's 2013 survey of the Afghan people, as well as a discussion of the Senate inquiry report on Australian aid to Afghanistan. Slides and other details are available on our website, devpolicy.anu.edu.au.
My name is Stephen Howes and I'm the Director of the Development Policy Centre. We're one part of the Crawford School and we are co-hosting this event along with the Asia Foundation. And I'll introduce our co-hosts in a minute, but let's first acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose land we meet and pay our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. Well, I'll say a little bit more in a minute in terms of today's event, but I'd like to first call on Gordon Hine, who's the Vice President of the Asia Foundation, our co-host, to say a few words of welcome. Thank you, Gordon.
Thank you very much, Stephen, and welcome to all of you. Thank you very much for coming out this evening for what should be a very interesting discussion on Afghanistan. We're delighted to be co-hosting this event with the Development Policy Center at the Crawford School here at ANU. In the last several years, we've been fortunate enough to work with Stephen and the Development Policy Center on a number of events, and it's a cooperation that we value very, very highly. Certainly, tonight's meeting comes at a very important time as we look towards next year in Afghanistan and the multiple transitions that the country will be facing. So it's a timely meeting. It's an important set of issues that our speakers will be addressing tonight. For those of you who don't know us, the Asia Foundation is a non-government, non-profit international development organization. We have our headquarters in San Francisco, where I'm based. But most importantly, we operate through a network of 18 country offices working on development issues on the ground. And our Afghanistan office opened in 1954. We closed during the Soviet time in 1979 and still had a Afghanistan program based in Peshawar in Pakistan for the refugee community. And then we were able to reopen our office in Afghanistan in 2002. We're very active working on a range of governance and women's empowerment, educational issues, and foreign affairs issues. Delighted to have two of our staff from our Afghanistan office here tonight, Mark Kreiser, who's our country representative, and Pawasha Kakar, who's the director of our women's empowerment programs, who are on the agenda. So I think without further ado, let me just, I'll just one final note. As you know, that one of the purposes of the meeting this evening is we're having the launch, the release of our annual survey of the Afghan people, which is a comprehensive public perception survey, what Afghans are thinking about a whole range of issues facing their country. This year marks the ninth year in a row that we've put out this survey, so it's an important event in that respect as well. So let me close there, and again thank you all for coming, and thank you to Stephen again. All right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot, Gordon. So we've got a lot to get through tonight, and whatever happens, we're going to finish by 7 o'clock, and I invite you to stay for tea and coffee afterwards. We've got really two reports, important reports, that we want to have discussed today. First, as Gordon mentioned, we're going to have launched here in Australia the Asia Foundation 2013 Afghanistan Survey Report by two of the authors of that report. And then we're delighted to welcome Senator Alan Eggleston tonight. Thank you very much, Senator, for coming. And as many of you will know, the Senate conducted an inquiry into Australian aid to Afghanistan. And one of our main interests in the Development Policy Centre, to be honest, we don't focus a lot on Afghanistan, but we do focus a lot on aid. And the Afghanistan aid program, I think it's become the fourth largest Australian aid program. In terms of the Australian aid program, it's become the fourth largest country program. So And we're also very keen to see a more parliamentary interest and oversight of the aid program. In fact, we suggested there could be a parliamentary committee or subcommittee on aid. So we were delighted that the Senate References Committee on Foreign Affairs, if I've got that right, took up the task of evaluating Australian aid to Afghanistan. And we've been wanting to organise an event to discuss that report, and I guess it's just been a busy year. So when the Asia Foundation approached us to launch their survey, we thought we'd also ask the members of that review if they'd come and discuss the report, and we were delighted that Senator Eggleston accepted our invitation because he chaired that inquiry, so no one better to speak to the report. And then finally, to get the discussion going, and we made it an hour and a half, so there will be time for discussion, we've asked one of our own, Nematullah Bazan. He is a PhD student here studying aid to Afghanistan, and he's also a prominent Afghan, put it that way. So we thought it'd be great to showcase some of the ANU talent on this subject, and so we've asked him to act as a discussant on both, and then we'll throw it open to you all for your questions and answers, and we'll have an interactive session. So that's the plan for today. I don't think I need to say more. I'm going to call on Mark Fraser to give the overview of the Asia Foundation report, and he'll be followed by Pabalsha Kakar, who's the director of the Afghanistan Women's Empowerment Program. So thank you very much, and over to you, Mark.
Great. Thank you, Stephen. Let me get our presentation up here. Thanks for coming tonight. As Gordon has mentioned, this is the ninth year in a row that we've done the survey. And this is the largest survey we've done. This year we interviewed 9,260 Afghan citizens across all 34 provinces of the country. I should tell you also that this is the formal media launch, so y'all, as we say from where I am in the United States, are the first ones to actually get the copies of the report. I think it's the best one we've done. I'm really excited about it. And as we stand here, as I stand here, my colleague Abdullah Ahmadzai and others in Kabul are doing the exact same thing. We're releasing the report in Kabul as we speak. Next week we'll be in Washington, D.C. for the launch, and then following that in London as well. What we're going to do today, we're just going to take about 20 to 30 minutes, and obviously we're not going to present everything that's in the survey book itself. What we're trying to do is pull out some interesting sample findings as we all start to think about the issues around transition. What are Afghans thinking in terms of security transition, political transition, economic transition? What are women saying? So we're just going to tease you a bit with some interesting responses as we go through this. If I had to sum up the headline, as we've been kind of pouring through this data over the last month or so as it's come in and we've produced a report, if I had to pull it up into a single headline, it would be that Afghans are very apprehensive. And you're going to see there's some fear in some areas as they move into 2014. Having said that, there's some surprising areas of cautious optimism, and we'll talk about that. For example, people are concerned about insecurity, not surprising, corruption and unemployment. Those three things keep bubbling up again and again throughout the data. A lot of concerns about personal safety, up from last year. Again, not a surprise. Confidence in a lot of the public institutions at the local level, the provincial level, are down a bit. And of course, there's a lot of concern among women about their future. What happens to them? What happens to their rights? What happens to education? Gains have been made over the last 12 years. Having said that, on the positive side, which is really interesting, we'll touch on this, still more people than last year feel the country is generally moving in the right direction. And we'll talk about that. We asked them, why do you say that? Some interesting responses. Confidence in the Afghan National Security Forces is up. Again, a hopeful sign for the security transition, which has completely happened now. The Afghan security forces, both the police and the army, are on the front lines this past year, providing security for the population. People are generally satisfied with the performance of government at the national level, overwhelmingly. That was an interesting response this year. And for me, probably the most significant finding was that the majority of those people surveyed said that they believe the upcoming elections will make their lives better. Very interesting. Why are they saying that? What's happening here? As I said, the survey itself is divided up into 9 chapters. I'm going to march through all this stuff, but there's, again, just a wealth of data in this edition. And what's interesting about it, you can disaggregate the data. You can look at women's responses by ethnic group, by income level, by education, by province level. So you get a real interesting perspective provincially about what people are saying and the differences around the country. We found that interesting. We'll point some of that out here this evening. Again, what we want to do is just to kind of break this down a bit. We'll say something. We have with us Dr. Keith Shaw, who's going to come up. He's our survey director, and he's our expert on methodology. And I just want him to say something briefly about it, because this year the methodology has been dramatically improved. And then we'll talk about the security and key transition issues.
Okay, well, as you know, the bare bones of any survey, the credibility of the survey rests on the reliability of the findings. And we made some dramatic improvements this year, both to the reliability, but also to the way that we go about gathering the information in the first place, and then also in the way that we analyze the information that we did get. So the main thing that we have to talk about is sample size. Everything depends on that. We increased it by 47% this year compared with previous years. Previous years, last year, 2012, was 6,290 respondents. This year, 9,260. Pretty difficult to achieve in a country like Afghanistan, in all 34 provinces, I should point out. The consequence of increasing that sample size then is reduced sampling error, i.e. the reliability of the findings, plus or minus 1.1% this year, plus or minus 5.1% last year. That's a big shift. On data acquisition, we could look at many areas to improve the quality of our data. But the three fundamental ones that we addressed this particular year were the starting point, the questionnaire. What sort of questions are you asking? How usefully do they measure the concepts intended? What's the influence of things like social desirability bias? Yes. We did some simple statistical analysis to try to identify questions that weren't really contributing much to our overall understanding of the findings and so on. So in any survey, you want to keep it short, the questionnaire. In fact, we got it up. We went from 102 questions to 110 questions this year. No way to avoid it. The average interview length was 38 minutes, though. That's about the maximum, I think, that most people can tolerate. Who you ask the questions of is also very important. When you get to a community, in the past, there's a tendency, if you're not directly supervised, for the enumerators or the interviewers to go to the first houses they can find. So we tried very hard this year to increase the randomness of household selection. And then lastly, something quite creative that we did. We got a lot of comments in previous years about the perceptions of respondents living in insecure areas that we couldn't access. What were those perceptions? So we thought up a way of getting around the door, as it were. We couldn't get in there. So we did interviews with people coming out to safer zones, to the bazaars, to transportation centres, whatever it may be. At least that gives you some sense of what they're thinking. It's not a random sample by any means, but it's some information. On data analysis, in previous years, we tended to stick to reporting straight percentages. This year, we did a fair bit of fundamental analysis, looking at differences, essentially. Those differences you could think of through two lenses. First, a geographical lens, looking at the differences and determining whether they were statistically significant, and therefore if they were reporting them, the differences between urban and rural areas, the differences between regions, and interestingly, as Marcus said, the differences between provinces, which can sometimes be quite dramatic, in one case from 5% to 95%. On the other side, the other lens we looked at was a demographic lens. I think these factors are really very important. We looked at other things, but these are the main ones. The influence of income level on the findings, educational level, gender, and ethnicity. Ethnicity being very important in Afghanistan in terms of perceptions. So that's what I'm going to say. I don't want to get in the way of the actual findings, which Mark will continue on with the security transition.
Thank you, Keith. As we talk about the security transition, we're talking about the transfer of security responsibilities to the Afghan National Security Forces, and it covers topics in the survey that relate to fear or personal safety, fear for your family, fear for traveling about Afghanistan, and the reporting of crime, what kinds of crime, those kinds of things. One of the questions that we've asked consistently, I think, in every survey we did over the last 9 years, as we approach transition, we ask people, in your view, what is the biggest problem facing Afghanistan as a whole? So not in your local area, but in the country as a whole. And you can see the three top responses there, and this hasn't changed from last year. So it's insecurity, corruption, unemployment, followed by poor economy. Again, those three top items of concern around insecurity, corruption, and employment seem to bubble up again and again through many of the questions themselves. One of the interesting things this year, as Keith had mentioned, we've been able to map the responses by province. So on this particular question, again, related to security and the transition of international forces to Afghanistan, we said, how often do you fear for your own personal safety or security for that of your family these days? And 59% said there was some to a lot of fear for themselves or their family. And again, you can see the different gradation, the darker provinces being a greater level of fear for their family or themselves. Then now this is up from last year. Last year we asked the same question. I think it was 48% said that they had some or a lot of fear. So it's up by 11 percentage points, which is interesting. Again, trying to gauge people's sense of fear or insecurity, we ask, would you participate in the following activities with some fear or a lot of fear? And again, you can see in the far right or your left there, when encountering the Afghan National Police, ANP, when encountering the Afghan National Army. And then for me, an interesting one, you're kind of a telling one, when traveling from one part of Afghanistan to another is interesting. Nice little laser here. This is interesting to me because I asked, you know, last year there wasn't that level of fear about traveling outside one's village, outside one's district. And we went back and looked, and indeed civilian casualties are up in 2013 from 2012 by 23%. So there's a lot of fear about traveling from one, the safety of one's immediate environment elsewhere, because the casualty rates, in which are well publicized, are very much up this year. In this next question, we asked, have you ever experienced crime or violence in the past year? And of those that we asked, the 9,200, 19%, yes, they did experience some kind of level of personal crime. And then we asked, well, where did you report that crime? And you can see going from the left-hand side there over to the right, more often than not, people did report it to the Afghan National Police, and then finally the local or informal justice system of the Shura or the elders. In a slide further down here, we asked some interesting questions about the formal justice system, meaning the police, the courts, versus the informal system of local Shura, tribal elders, that kind of thing. And there's some interesting responses there in terms of where people go to report crime and which institutions they trust more. And just out of interest, we also asked, what types of crimes did people experience last year? And the top three responses were physical personal attacks or beatings, extortion, and theft of livestock. So those are the three most experienced and reported crimes last year. Another interesting thing, what we found over last year is the respondents' willingness to report crime is up significantly. So in 2012, 52% said that they were willing to report a crime. And this year, it's 64%, which is quite a jump. And again, we're just trying to sift through as to what does that signify? What does that mean? Again, with the key element of the security transition being the transfer of security responsibilities to the Afghan National Police and Afghan National Army, we did ask, what's your confidence level in the Afghan National Police? And you can see the response here. 72% had some to a good deal of confidence in the Afghan National Police. And again, it's interesting to see how this people responded by province And some surprises for me, you know, in the far southwestern Nimruz, Helmand, Uruzgan, where your country has made a significant investment, a lot of confidence in the Afghan National Police, whereas in some of the other provinces, less so. Again, similar question, confidence level in the Afghan National Army. 88% said that they had some to a good deal of confidence in the army. Again, in places where there, in the last few years, where there's been significant investment by the United States, Canada, Australia, and the UK, confidence levels are up. Interestingly, though, 76 of those people surveyed said that they believe that the Afghan National Army still needs foreign support to do their job, and that's up from 67% last year. So a lot of confidence in the Afghan National Army, but a belief that they still need external support, according to the respondents. Here in this question, again, we're trying to gauge people's fear of participating in what I would call just basic activities that of any democracy, right? So we're talking about participating in resolving community problems, voting in the national or provincial elections, participating in a demonstration, or running for public office. What's the result of our investment over the last 12 years? Have people's willingness to participate in basic democratic activities increase? And for me, the interesting one here is that we get 59% say they have a lot or some fear of participating in the national upcoming election on April 5th. And related to that question, 80% of those people said that they would decide on polling day itself, depending on the security situation, whether they would vote or not vote. So again, people thinking about security, a good deal of fear around certain things, but you'll see in some of the data later on, despite this fear, there's a good deal of hope that the next election is going to change people's lives for the better. So again, those were just some samples of the 108 questions that we asked around things relating to security. Let me just say something quickly about the political transition. And when we talk about the political transition, we cover topics like the elections, confidence in public institutions, willingness to participate in civic activities, those kinds of things. And for me, and again, I referred to this earlier on and just a minute ago, question was, do you think the result of the presidential election in 2014 is likely to make your life better, make your life worse, or have no impact on your life? Again, quite surprising. 56% believe that this election is going to make their life better. You know, and why is that? Why in so much of the survey responses we're seeing some fear, some pessimism, some negativity, yet this positive response on thinking the election is going to make things better? Is it because of, like any government, after 10 years of any administration, whether it's in my country or your country, you know, you're always looking for a change and hoping that that next administration, that next election perhaps is going to make your life better. I don't know. But it's, again, interesting response, something we didn't quite expect. I should also say that 61% of the people we interviewed, of the 9,260, said that they expect the elections to be free and fair. 61%. Pretty significant. Again, just the same question, just mapped out by province, but as we looked at it, again, I focus on these southwestern provinces where there's been a lot of, you know, military activity, you know, Helmand, Kandahar, Uruzgan, Ghazni, and across the tier provinces of the north. Again, a lot of hope that the next election is going to make their lives better. In this question, again, how much influence do you think someone like you can have over local government decisions? And again, we just chose this question to show you that how you can kind of track the data over time, the longitudinal changes here. You can see a high in 2008 of 66% who thought they could have some influence, or a lot, or some, I should say, over local government. And you see kind of a slight decline. It wouldn't make too much of it since 2009. But again, every question like this, the core set of questions, can be tracked over time to see how perceptions have changed. And what's really interesting for us is to take those questions and place them in a historical context. So what was going on when we did the survey from July 17th to July 27th this year? What was happening in the country? what was going on that may have influenced or impacted some of these responses. And in, actually, in the survey itself, we try to pull out some of those things a little bit to help us all understand the data. Again, the same question, just mapped by province again. And as Keith had mentioned, you can drill down into each province by ethnic group, by education level, urban versus rural, how people are responding, what they're thinking. Another interesting question, again, something very basic to any democracy, which we've all invested in, both our Afghan partners and the international community over the last 12 years, and something the Asia Foundation works in a lot, is it acceptable to criticize the government in public? 75% respond, yes, it is, which is, again, interesting, very, very, very positive. And again, when you look at the provincial responses, Helmand, Uruzgan, where your country's made a great investment, people feel free to criticize their government. And you would think that that would be a basic principle of anybody living within a democratic society. Again, consistent with people's perception that amongst the three largest problems in Afghanistan, corruption is right there at the top. Please tell me whether you think that corruption is a major problem in the following areas. And you can see in your daily life, in your neighborhood, local authorities, your provincial government, or Afghanistan as a whole. This is actually about the same as we found last year. You know, people are still very, very concerned about corruption, but it hasn't really gone up or down significantly. This, for me, is another telling finding. The question was, please tell me how much confidence you have in the following public institutions to do their job. And you can see on the left-hand side there, the institutions we're talking about is electronic media, radio, religious leaders, community sharejiggers, right down the line. And if you look at the right-hand column here, every one of these institutions is at the lowest level of confidence rating since we've been asking the question in 2006. So you can see a trending degradation of confidence in public institutions. Again, and I come back to that one response of 66% thinking that the next election has the possibility of improving their lives. Is it perhaps related to decreasing confidence in existing public institutions and thinking that the next election is surely to produce, you know, at least a different administration? Some people say that local religious leaders should be consulted on problems facing their area, while others think that politics and religion should not mix. Again, the top line there looks at the religious leaders should be consulted, and you can see a significant decrease over last year. The bottom line, people who are saying that religion and politics should not mix, again, that's up as well. And there's some interesting reasons behind that. This is an interesting slide. Do you agree with the following statement about the state courts versus the local shura-jurga system? Again, comparing people's confidence in the formal justice system versus the informal justice system. You can see in the red bars there's more confidence in general in the informal justice system. Not a surprise to us. And I think this is our last one here. Again, the question was, do you agree with the reconciliation efforts between the government and the armed opposition groups, AOG, i.e. the Taliban? 63% say they do agree with that. And again, interesting to see the southern tier provinces and tier provinces across the north. Related to this question, there was a follow-on. The question was, to what degree do you sympathize with the armed opposition? Last year, 30% of the respondents said they had some sympathy for the Taliban. This year, it's 35%. When we asked, why is that? The number one response was corruption. Corruption in the existing government. That was the reason, main reason people responded. They have some sympathy for the opposition. With that, let me just turn it over to Paul Washa, and she'll just quickly go through the women in transition piece.
As Keith mentioned earlier, this year's survey analysis looked at responses by gender and reported any significant differences in all the chapters. So I do urge you to look through the survey book because it does have some interesting stuff on gender throughout all the chapters. We also asked some interesting new questions this year, specifically on whether respondents think women, whether there should be equal rights under the law regardless of gender, things like whether state courts treat men and women differently, and whether they agree with forms of forced marriage like Bad and Madal. So those are some interesting topics to look at in the book. one question I wanted to start this this Women in Transition section on was about political leadership. The question we asked is, do you think that both men and women should have equal representation in political leadership? And although we see, is it working? All right. Although we see there hasn't been a very significant drop here, it's been on a decline since 2008. And we've seen that in the public, we've actually witnessed this decline in terms of the support for women's quotas in the provincial councils that have been reduced by 5%, and also the controversy in Parliament over the elimination of violence against women law. We also looked at this question in terms of by gender, in terms of what men and women think. We can see equal for both men and women. More women think that it should be equal for both, and more men think it should be just mostly for men. The next question we asked is, do you think that women should decide who to vote for themselves? Overall, 53% think that women should decide who to vote for themselves. More people in the urban areas think that women should decide who to vote for themselves, and of course, between men and women, more women think that. Mark mentioned what are the biggest problems at the national level. This was a question about what are the biggest problems facing women today. Interesting, similar to the national level, there's a concern for unemployment, for lack of jobs for women, but education and literacy is high according to these categories. Lack of women's rights comes in third. But if we actually look at these three together as lack of women's rights, it's interesting that these have been quite high. When we graph this together, those three categories, and we see an interesting trend here. Last year, it was about the same as education and literacy. This year, slightly up, but in 2011, very high in terms of people's concerns. We asked the question, if you know of a place where women can go to have their problems resolved, what organization or institution or authority is that? Of those who said yes, they know of a place, that's 18%. The Directorate of Women's Affairs has been the highest these past few years at 46% this year. Interesting to see that the Human Rights Council, which was non-existent in 2011, is now at 13%, the second highest place that they know of. In terms of women, actually 21% of women knew of this place. So that 18 is a total, but gender segregated is 21% women. And this is just looking at it differently in terms of mapping it out in terms of those who recognize the Directorate of Women's Affairs at 46%. Again, we see a very strong recognition in Hilman, Zabul, and there's some holes there in terms of people not recognizing that's at the 0% level. It's interesting to look at the data that way for us as we plan our programs. Here we graph two questions together. The first one is, do you agree or disagree that women should have the same opportunities as men in education, along with those who rate their local availability of education as good? And we see a slight decrease here as those who rate the availability of education this year, and also a slight decrease similarly as those who think that there should be equal opportunities. We've seen a similar trend line here in the earlier years. So it's just an interesting way to look at what might affect this idea of equal opportunities, although it has been significantly high across the years. Another question we asked was, what is your opinion on women being allowed to work outside the home? And here we've graphed the responses of women should not be allowed to work outside the home. And we see this increasing trend, slight increase from last year, but since 2006 it's been on the increase in terms of people thinking that women should not be allowed to work outside the home. This year, actually, with the transition and the PRTs closing down, we did a very small study in Faryab where we actually have some work that we're doing on trust building between the state and communities in terms of the effect of the PRT shutting down and that an effect it has on women. We saw that women as soon as the PRT shut down, there was a lot of security problems. Women weren't allowed to go to school, weren't allowed to go to work because of security concerns. More women started wearing the burqas when they went outside. And families felt insecure because of the threat of kidnapping and harassment on the streets to allow their women and girls in their homes outside. So that's something to think about in terms of why this is increasing here. And then on the economic transition, this is the biggest problems at your local area. Again, at the national level, it was insecurity, unemployment, and corruption, and here unemployment is the highest at the local level, in terms of the question of the local level. Electricity, roads, drinking water, these play an important role, and security comes down here as fifth. And that really shows the perspective at the local level in terms of what the issues people are dealing with. This is just looking at respondents who are unemployed by gender. Women respondents who are unemployed and male respondents who are unemployed, pretty similar between the 2 years. And then the next slide is looking at this, those who say they're unemployed, and that is those meaning that they are not paid for work, 48% overall, and this has been mapped out. It's interesting to see the highest respondents that said that they are not employed is in the central area, Kabul, Kapisan, Panjshir, and the lowest is in Paktika. We also had a question on, do female members of the family contribute to household income or not? 17% recognized and said yes. And it's interesting to map that out to see here, Paktika is now dark. And we have some relative areas where there are dark in terms of those recognizing women's income. Nuristan is not surprising, considering that women participate in doing some heavy work there. The average household income of people that we interviewed was around 10,000 Afghanis, which is about $200. The average household size was about 9 people. And it's interesting when we look at this data by rural and urban, women in rural areas are more likely to contribute to household income at 20% than in urban areas, which is at 13%. So this is, of those who said yes, women contribute to 17%, how much do they contribute to the total income? And see, we see most say, 64% say it's less than 25%, whereas 27% say it's between 26% and 50%. Here we ask the question, how would you rate today's conditions in the village where you live? And these are the good and very good responses. For electricity, we are seeing an increase slight there, but everything else is pretty much a decrease or about the same. And when we look at availability of clinics, this is access to clinics issues. So again, service delivery. And when we saw in the previous slides that Mark presented, there is this decrease in confidence in local provincial government. And we see this might be some of the reasons why there is that decrease in terms of decrease in availability for education, decrease in hospitals, clinics, medicine, those sort of things. Now, of course, one question that we've been asking for a long time is, do you think the country is moving in the right direction? And we see we have this increase. But then we ask the question, why? So we're looking for the reasons. What do Afghans really think in terms of why it's moving in the right direction? And it's not what most people might think are the reasons. The big reason here is reconstruction. And we've seen this, it's very interesting that where projects are actually recognized at the local level is where there's hard reconstruction projects in terms of roads, irrigation systems, and that people locally are employed in those projects. So that's a lot of what contributes to the right direction in terms of where people are looking at. Of course, security also contributes to that. And then education, both of these, improvement in education system and opening of girls' schools. And this is mapping out the national mood by provinces. Again, we see a very strong color here in Helmand. Uruzgan is also very strong. A lot of this has to do with not only the capacity building, but also the reconstruction projects in this area. And it gets to, again, that issue of national mood being having to do with more, not what the government's doing, not with service delivery, but more with reconstruction and what they're experiencing on the ground in terms of employment. And just to sum up, this is where you can find, there is a mapping of the results on our website, so you're welcome to look there and see the results by province of some key questions. But just to sum up, that Afghans are very hopeful, it seems, for the 2014 election, although they did cite that security was a major concern. And more than half say that the outcome of the 2014 election will make a positive difference in their lives. At the same time, most Afghans, that's 81%, say that election day security conditions are the major factor in their decision to travel to polling stations to vote. So with that, I will end and hope to hear from you in terms of questions. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Mark and Hawasha. There's a lot of rich information there, so just hold your questions and thoughts, and I'd now like to call on Senator Alan Eggleston. I'll just introduce him by saying he's a Senator for Western Australia, and he's been a Senator for Western Australia since 1996. Thank you very much, Senator, for coming along. We're looking forward to what you have to say. I can
thank you very much.
Is there no PowerPoint?
No PowerPoint, I'm afraid.
I'm just going to talk, if that's all right. So thank you very much for inviting me here. It's very nice to be here, a great privilege, and it's a great follow-up on the report that the Senate Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade References Committee did on Australia's involvement in Afghanistan and our aid programs. Australia first became involved in Afghanistan on the premise that the scourge of Al-Qaeda, the world's leading terror force, needed to be curtailed, and the belief that Afghanistan was arguably a place where terrorism was very active. In a speech made in April last year, Defence Minister Stephen Smith cited the oft-referenced adage that people may not remember how you arrived, but they certainly remember how you leave. So with that in mind, I'd like to turn to looking at Australia's overseas development programs in Afghanistan by providing an overview of the committee's report into the effectiveness of our aid in Afghanistan. In 2001, after two decades of civil war, the government of Afghanistan faced the daunting task of creating an environment that would enable its people to start the process of rebuilding their country's economy, its vital infrastructure and state institutions. Many Afghanis needed to be resettled, the injured to be rehabilitated, farmers returned to their land, and children to return to school. The challenges confronting the country and its people were and remain formidable. Australia became part of the international donor community, pledged to assist Afghanistan with its recovery and reconstruction. From 2000 to June 2012, Australia's overseas development assistance to Afghanistan amounted to some $710 million. Australia is now committed to making Afghanistan its third largest recipient in volume of overseas direct aid, with a total development assistance for Afghanistan budget to climb to $250 million for the year 2015-2016. Australia uses a number of channels to distribute its overseas direct aid in Afghanistan. Afghan's core budget, multilateral organisations and NGOs, and the Uruzgan Provincial Reconstruction Team. The bulk of Australia's overseas aid goes to Afghanistan's core budget, so we provide the aid through the Afghani government. Overall evidence supports the view that funds directed through the Afghani government, notably through the Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund, are more successful in promoting government ownership and aligning projects with government priorities than other avenues. We believe this arrangement helps to prevent the waste of funds, encourages stronger coordination between projects, that is less duplication and better targeting, and is better suited to counter corruption. And our committee fully endorsed Australia's commitment to allocate 50% of its aid to Afghanistan through budget mechanisms, and supports Australia's continuing contribution to the Afghani budget system. For many years, Australia has also challenged a significant proportion of its aid to Afghanistan through NGOs. The committee acknowledged the good work being achieved through the mechanism and recognises that NGOs will have an important continuing role during Afghanistan's transition to self-reliance and beyond. In particular, we believe that NGOs will be required to continue to fill the gap in the Afghan government's capacity to deliver frontline services. The committee, however, recognised the importance of building the capacity of local NGOs and other Afghan civil society organisations to serve their communities, and underscores the importance of ensuring that they figure prominently in the design, planning and implementation of aid programs. After Australia assumed leadership of the PRT in Uruzgan in 2010, the proportion of Australia's aid to that province increased substantially, and it now accounts for around 20% of Australia's total aid to Afghanistan. Australia's assistance to Uruzgan has produced tangible benefits from reconstruction work or restoration of important infrastructure such as schools, health clinics, roads and bridges, to helping the provincial government develop a cadre of trained public servants. Some witnesses have expressed reservations about aid delivered through the Australian Defence Force in Uruzgan, suggesting that some projects were quick fixes and unsustainable. And it's also been suggested in relation to the military's involvement in development assistance that it may put the safety of aid recipients or non-military aid workers at risk, and by supporting or even empowering particular individuals, undermine local ownership. In some quarters, the involvement of the army in aid programs was regarded as suggesting the purpose was military rather than humanitarian, and we think there should have been or should be a comprehensive independent evaluation of the effectiveness of the work of the PRT under Australian leadership, and such a review would provide a great opportunity to understand better and to learn lessons from Australia's military civil policing operations in Uruzgan. The most important thing we think we have to do is protect the gains. With the assistance of donor countries such as Australia, Afghanistan has made considerable progress in lifting living standards, the living standards of its people, and stabilising its government. However, Afghanistan remains in need of substantial and continuing aid to maintain its development momentum. While views certainly differ on Afghanistan's future security, all agree that it is unpredictable and that the legacy of the country's long and destructive history of political turbulence and of civil and military upheavals will continue to present enormous difficulties in that country. The projected fall in Afghanistan's revenue base will further complicate the government's efforts to provide adequately for its people. Clearly, there is a serious risk that in the light of the decline in government revenue and continuing insecurity, advances in key areas such as the provision of education and health services may be unsustainable or even reversed. To defend the gains, our committee believed that it is critical that aid programs should focus on three points. Firstly, continuity, ensuring that the transition to self-reliance is sure-footed and smooth. Secondly, consolidation, ensuring that the gains made to date are not lost and instead form a solid foundation for future growth. Move, in fact, from quantity to quality, for example, from school buildings to teaching, and ensuring that operational costs such as salaries, maintenance and repairs to buildings and infrastructure are all covered. And thirdly, that we should have a more strategic focus, ensuring that attention is given to the sectors that are foundational and have a proven track record of success. In this context, there are a few areas in which Australia could continue to direct its efforts most productively, these being, in our view, education, agriculture, mining, and promoting the status of women. Let's just go through them in turn. Education, is not only a sector where notable achievements have been made, but also one of the key building blocks for the future development of Afghanistan, and an area where Australia could continue to make a very valuable contribution. The committee supported the concept of Australia placing a very high priority on education in its Afghan aid programs, but would like to see a much greater emphasis given to improving school attendance and the quality of teaching. To achieve high retention rates and uninterrupted schooling, the aid program must address the obstacles holding parents back from sending their children to school, especially female children. It must also seek to provide a pathway to higher education, in our view. In this regard, the community-based program, the Australian-funded program Children of Uruzgan, and the Malaysia-Australian Education Project for Afghanistan, we felt held promise. The various aid programs offering scholarships to study in Australia could be developed further, in our view, and attention should be given to building on the experiences of Afghan graduates from Australian universities, for example, by encouraging and supporting an active alumni community. Agriculture and food security is also a matter which we thought was very important to the future stability of Afghanistan, and we felt with its expertise in the area of dry land agriculture, Australia is very well placed to continue its significant role in assisting Afghani agriculturalists, including its poorer farmers, to improve the productivity of their land. The committee identified three areas having the potential to increase the benefits already accruing from international assistance in agriculture, these being improved accessibility for poorer farmers to the advances being made through research, emphasis on training farmers, and including women in every facet of improving agricultural production. The committee also was also of the view that Australia's assistance to Afghanistan in the food security sector, should pay close attention to these areas. The heavy reliance on opium production in some districts in Afghanistan, we felt, underscores the important role that development assistance should have in enticing farmers away from the cultivation of the opium poppy by providing them with viable alternative agricultural crops. Mining is another area where we thought Australia could be of assistance to Afghanistan. Afghanistan has abundant mineral resources and is seeking to learn more about mining from countries such as ours, which have extensive experience in the industry, not only in terms of the technology of mining, but also perhaps in advice on the legal framework under which mining is conducted. At the Africa Down Under Mining Conference held in Perth this year, in fact the 11th Africa Down Under Conference in Perth, where African governments and companies come to Perth, Western Australia, to hold a conference about mining, the Premier of Western Australia, Colin Barnett, offered to assist African governments set up the legal framework for mining agreements which would protect the interests of the people of the country concerned, and hopefully that kind of advice could also be provided to the Afghani government to protect their mining ventures. In the light of the serious concerns expressed as well about the sorry history of mining in conflict-affected countries, our committee believed that a much greater effort is required to help Afghanistan ensure that mineral exploration and extraction does not harm local communities, and that the benefits from mining are spread throughout the Afghani economy. Turning to private enterprise and the Afghan diaspora, the committee believed that, or expressed the view that Afghanistan needs a healthy private business sector in order to drive the necessary economic growth that would provide income earning opportunities and generate the revenue needed for government to provide essential services. In this regard, the committee had the view that DFAT, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, to our American friends, and AusAid should be looking at creative and practical ways to encourage Australian organisations, including within the Afghan diaspora, to forge links with the business and academic communities in Afghanistan. And we were particularly interested in the role of women in Afghanistan and expressed the view that to lift its people out of poverty, Afghanistan must include women as part of the development process. The committee noted that Afghanistan has identified gender equality itself as a cross-cutting issue central to the success of its overall development strategy. Evidence suggests, however, we found that as Afghanistan draws closer to taking charge of its own affairs, much more needs to be done to improve and then safeguard the status of women. The committee commended the Australian government for its strong recognition of the rights of women in its aid programs, and also noted the opportunities to encourage gender equality through Australia's contribution to training and mentoring the Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police. We had a look at the what we regarded as the effectiveness of Australia's overseas aid to Afghanistan, overseas direct aid, and while we acknowledge the work of Australian aid personnel in Afghanistan and their commitment to help the Afghan people rebuild their lives, we did feel that the evidence suggested that some projects had not measured up to expectations, such as Alice Garn and the Australian Leadership Awards Scholarship Program for Afghani students. And there are other projects indicating that while impressive on paper, the achievements on the ground may not be as substantial as initial indicators had suggested. In this regard, the committee has seen little evidence that Australian government agencies delivering aid to Afghanistan have attempted any really genuine critical evaluation of the effectiveness of our programs, including assessment of their cost effectiveness. Overall, the committee found that the current reporting system presents an incomplete picture and in fact may mask significant underachievement. For example, the information is provided on the number of schools built and enrolment rates, but there's no record of attendances, retention, or the quality of teaching. And they're much more important indicators than just putting up a building and saying, well, we've got a school there. We want to know how effective that school is in that community. The committee believed that the monitoring, evaluation, and reporting of Australia's aid to Afghanistan needs to improve dramatically, and that the benefits of robust evaluation and reporting would be twofold. Deficiencies could be identified, rectified, and valuable insights gained for refining future programs, and the government would be better placed to tell the Australian public about the achievements which often go unnoticed. So in conclusion, the committee found that Australia, in its areas of influence, which is Irrisgan province, which is only a small part of Afghanistan, as one can see from the maps that have been placed on the board during the course of this presentation, that in our areas, area of influence, Australia has made a major contribution to the reconstruction of infrastructure and the development of educational facilities, as well as support for the recognition of the rights of women in Afghan society. And while indeed we have much to be proud of in what we've done so far, the task is not yet over, and we need to provide assistance to the programs to consolidate the gains which have been made in Afghanistan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. I think it's a very balanced and insightful report. Before we go to discussion, I know we're running a little short. I'll ask Nimmat to keep his comments brief, but I did want to give him the chance because he's about to finish his PhD. He's thought long and hard about Afghanistan and aid to Afghanistan, and I thought it would be great if you can kick off the discussion with a few reflections.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a great pleasure to be here with you. And I just submitted my PhD thesis last week, so I'm a little bit relieved. I was studying the impact of foreign aid on Afghanistan state building. Coming to the issue of Afghanistan, to briefly put it in a context, as we know, since the Taliban was ousted from the power in the late 2001, foreign aid has contributed to economic growth, the promotion of education, and the expansion of health services. However, these improvements remain largely dependent on continuing aid. Because of a high aid dependence context in Afghanistan and the centrality of evidence-based policy formulation, aid accountability through different mechanisms, especially better legislations and surveys which can inform policies, are of high importance. Especially today, we saw two important reports which were discussed, the Asia Foundation Survey of the Afghans and the Senate Report Committee. And the latter, I had the privilege to speak to the Senate Committee and provide my recommendations and suggestions on how to improve the Australian overseas aid management in Afghanistan. I would like to start from the Senate Committee report and make a few observations. The Senate Committee report on how to improve the management and effectiveness of Australian aid to Afghanistan was a credible and highly professional assessment of aid to Afghanistan. Experts, practitioners, politicians, and even locals were able to participate in that process. Therefore, I would like to congratulate Senator Eglinton and his colleagues for this. The recommendations have addressed few areas and provided 36 precise or concise recommendations, as Senator talked about, including Australia's civil-military role in Afghanistan, its unintended implications on development and institution building, Australian scholarships to Afghanistan to be recommenced, which is now pending, resettlements for Afghans who have assisted Australia's mission in Afghanistan, education to focus on quality, agriculture and food security, mining to provide technical assistance in this area, and aid mobility with particular emphasis to use Afghan government system, channeling up to 50% of Australian aid through government budget and local NGOs to foster the use of local NGOs. And last but not least, women in Afghanistan to retain the gains and make aid through women. However, there are a few concerns about these recommendations. First, they do not have particular deadline and therefore it's difficult to assess their implementation in a given time frame. For example, although there was a recommendation that the scholarships to Afghanistan should be recommenced, it's not clear whether this could happen for the next year or not. More importantly, the new government policy of slashing aid may undermine the overarching goals to defend the gains and sustain the current level of development in Afghanistan. As Senator mentioned, that there were three overarching objectives for recommended to sustain the gains and defend. This is one of the area or of the concerns. While it's imperative the legislator should engage in overseeing the Australian aid to Afghanistan, even in the future, it could emphasize on a role for the Afghan legislature too, because also they can play a similar role in Kabul to hold the Afghan government into account for aid expenditures. However, also there is a concern in terms of implementation that this type of exercise should foster implementation and avoid creating barriers in already complex aid architecture. Mostly, overall, the recommendations has focused on the adjustments in the current programs. And of course, those are vital for improving the implementation. But also there could be much consideration to look at other measures to reforming the Australian aid architecture and processes, which could improve significantly the effectiveness and management of aid and offer lots of lessons to other donors in Afghanistan and beyond. But overall, the assessment of the aid was very professional and credible, and it could help and improve the process in the future. Coming to the next point, in terms of the Asian survey of Afghans, overall, it provides a mixed picture about Afghanistan, as you saw in the presentation from colleagues. And they did a brilliant job, congratulations, especially in terms of institution building, governance, economy, security. And also, I want to add that July is a time that in Afghanistan people are happy, it's summer. This survey is widely used by Afghanistan researchers, especially at ANU. We got your database, thank you for that. And policymakers, and because of its long duration and broad scope, has made it a unique survey of Afghan people's opinion. In particular, in a politically contentious context of Afghanistan, where there is war of propaganda and many players fuel pessimism and optimism, it's very important to provide a real picture of the public opinion. And this is, I can say, the only one in Afghanistan. Especially one of the important aspects of the survey is that it shows the national mood about the direction of the country. And we saw that since 2002, there has been a positive trend in terms of direction of the country or the public perception in that regard. This survey in particular challenges the current securitized discourse on Afghanistan and shows that at the national level, the biggest problems are related to governance, economy, and security. Many people or politicians are concerned about security transition in Afghanistan, but this survey says, no, it's security, corruption, which is governance, and unemployment, which is economy. So there should be a balanced approach towards transition. This could inform the presidential candidates, policies, and donors, and Afghan government, especially as they are lagging behind to other the governance and economic needs of the country. One of the important findings, which gives a very good picture in terms of local needs, at a local level, most of the problems that people express, the biggest problems at the locals, are related to economy. So in terms of its priority, top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and this can inform the policy discourse and policy formulation in Afghanistan. And I would like to conclude here that overall, this is like a very important survey, and congratulate you all. And yeah, thank you.
So if I can ask various speakers to come up the front. Yeah, so please just introduce yourself and fire away.
I'm a bit concerned about tonight's presentation about Afghanistan. It seems to be fairly sort of more positive. Yet for 12 years, Western countries have been there with their military forces, putting huge amounts of aid into the country. Yet we still have these extraordinarily serious problems in the country. Now, obviously, there has been some mistakes made. There are some really serious issues here, which maybe were touched upon just by the last speaker, but I think we need to have a more frank and open and honest discussion about what the situation is in the country. My inclination is to believe that the United States took the lead, and the United States, under George Bush, certainly made a lot of mistakes in the way they conducted and carried out their foreign affairs, and there seems to be something wrong with the Afghani government, a lot of allegations of serious corruption, entailing people very close to the president.
Okay.
Why wasn't that fixed up? I mean, these sort of quite meaty sort of issues really need to be acknowledged and really be openly and frankly discussed.
Okay, so I think are we being too optimistic? So let's take a few questions and then we'll let different members of the panel take up which ones they want, because we don't have a lot of time here. Please.
Thank you. I'm Jawal Abbas, and I've been working on Afghan refugees and Afghan migrants in Australia and Iran. I visited Afghanistan in July, and I spoke to different people about the situation in Afghanistan. And particularly, I was interested in the data that you collected and the congratulated data that you have collected. One issue that I was interested, actually, that you didn't address in the presentation was the age component of the data that you collected. You didn't show us the cohort analyses of the sample that you collected, and you didn't compare the views of the young versus older generations and see how their views are different. And secondly, taking the comment from the senator in account about the importance of education, and given that Development Policy Center is organizing this, I would suggest that I think it would be better, instead of presenting only provincial differences in every slide, focus on development and factors, particularly education. I've just finished a paper looking at fertility of migrants, Afghan migrants in Iran versus native groups. And I think if you compare the fertility of educated Afghans, it is no difference basically with Iranian, with second generation Afghans in Iran. I think it would be good to focus on education in every province, and that's the direction that the country should take, rather than going only regional and province, because province, it replicates ethnicity and other issues that is prevailing in Afghanistan's
culture. Good. Thank you very much. There was one more.
Yeah. My name is Ali Reza. I'm doing my PhD in politics and higher education in Afghanistan. I have actually two questions, one on methodology. And the one that seems to me is that in one particular category of development and service delivery, 67% of women who responded were uneducated. It seems to me that you have used probably translators or interpreters, or your interviews have probably been present while talking with the people. Culturally speaking, the Afghans were very reluctant when they asked questions about the government or people who serve them to say yes, rather than, so that yes could not be really on the yes to your question, but yes to confirmation that really they would be shy or would be fearful of responding in particular to the service to the government. So that's one. How do you actually ensure the credibility of these the statistics if the interviewer are not present there? That's one that I had in terms of methodology. In terms of the other issue that came up, you argued that insecurity became a very much prominent or major problems nationally, but when you ask women in what education they're interested in, how do you actually ensure that women nationally think that insecurity is a major issue when it comes to particular issue, gender, they think the issue is a major issue?
All right, so we've got a good set of questions there, and who would like to start?
Why hasn't more been done? That's a very good question. I mean, when you look where Afghanistan is starting from after 35 years of war, I mean, I've been there for 10 years. When I first pulled into Kabul in 2002, I was astonished. I used to live there in the 80s under the Soviet occupation. And to come into the country at that time, we've all seen pictures of Berlin after the Second World War. That's what Kabul looked like. I spent 3 years working in the office of the president under a program, and I was astonished. The president was sending messages to his cabinet by bicycle. There was no email, there was no electricity often, there was nothing. So I think, you know, in this massive, massive, massive undertaking where my country has put in over $93 billion just on the aid side, not let alone the military, I look back at it, and I look at some of the things that I myself designed. I think when we went in 2002, there was a lot of naivete in a sense. There was a real buoyancy. There was a real optimism. There was the Afghan diaspora was coming back. You know, friends of Afghanistan was going in. And frankly, we thought we could do a lot more in that space of time than is ever realistic. But I look back on the last 12 years, the 10 years of my life there, and I say, what has been accomplished? You know, I see 6 million kids back, little girls back in school. That's a good thing. I see 56% of the population believing that the next election is ahead, some improvement on their life. Again, and I think about the massive information that all our governments have made in trying to imbue this very alien idea of democracy. You know, just what is that? And my conclusion is that, and I've witnessed every election and every jirga since the emergency jirga in 2002, and people's consciousness have been raised about democracy, what their rights are, the effect that they can have some effect on local government. So the other positive thing that I see is that I see after 12 years of our massive intervention, I see this huge pool of human resources that have been trained, that have been educated abroad, have been educated in Afghanistan, that have worked with organizations like ours. And those people are staying behind. Whoever takes control of the next government, whatever happens, those people are going to remain. So, again, disappointment that we haven't taken that country into the 21st century. Maybe we take it in somewhere in midway in the 20th century. But I remind myself of where we started from and what's being left behind. So it's a mixed bag, for sure.
Good. Thank you. Do you want to answer about the survey?
Sure. I think on the methodology questions, I'll leave it to Keith to respond to some of those. But in terms of the biggest problem for women, just to clarify, it was not just female respondents. It's all respondents. Both men and women asked what's the biggest problem for women. So it was asked differently. What's the biggest problem at the national level? What's the biggest problem for women? And when being asked what's the biggest problem for women, both male and female respondents cited education and illiteracy as the top, and then it was an open-ended question, and it was coded a certain way, and so lack of rights was one of the ways it was coded, and then forced marriages and domestic violence came after that. So that was asked about problems for women, so it's different than the national level question, which was asked, what is the biggest problem in Afghanistan as a whole, the national level, and then again asked at the local level, just to clarify. But Keith can give some more.
And on the influence of observers on the answers given, there's always an issue. For example, significantly more people, when asked if they could read Pashtun, did yes when they were on their own, when they were present in the room, compared to when they were on their own, just with people. When we were looking at literacy, that proved really a challenge to get accurate answers on. You can see that of those that you might define as illiterate, still 22% said they could read, that had any form of education. In fact, for women, it's interesting. I think 76% of women reported not having had any form of education. So amongst the suite of questions on education, you get some that you might believe more than others, depending on the sensitivity of those questions and who was observing the prior act, which is a challenge for any survey.
So
okay.
We'll just hold a bit, because we're going to run out of time.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that it wasn't translated. The questionnaires are in Dari and Pashto, and they were asked in the language by local people in those communities. So it, people in the communities were hired to do that questionnaire. It wasn't, there wasn't any foreign presence in the question, in asking the question.
Yeah, Senator?
Yes, I could make a comment. The questioner said that the panel was too optimistic. And I think that's a very interesting comment.
I didn't say that.
You didn't? All right. Well, I wrote it down as that way. But I think it's possible we all probably are a bit too optimistic about Afghanistan. There are enormous problems there. There's a culture to overcome which doesn't really want to include women in lifestyle and business and the sort of things that we would include women in. And I think we have to be realistic in saying that the achievement of the kind of goals we want to achieve in bringing Afghanistan into the modern world, if you like, with a vibrant sort of civil society and a democratic process is going to be quite a difficult thing to do. But it's a long road, and at least we've started walking down it. And I'm sure that the countries that are there providing aid in various ways will continue to do so, and slowly but surely, I'm sure we'll see improvement. Or at least I certainly hope so.
Just to add a few points, until 2005, in terms of the overall achievements and the perception was very positive from inside and outside. But Afghanistan is not a post-war country because it immediately entered into a complex geopolitical process in the region. So to some extent, some kind of war is going on in Afghanistan or around Afghanistan. And therefore, most of the financial resources overwhelmingly concentrated on military priorities, and the development ones also followed that one. So what happened in Afghanistan, that there was contradictions in peace building and war on terror objectives. Therefore, now we can see lots of challenges ahead of the country. But in terms of the achievements, if we look, compare Afghanistan with another country, yes, there is lots of problems. If we compare Afghanistan with Afghanistan pre-2001, it has totally transformed. But as I said at the beginning, yet it's a fragile country and there is need for continued support and foreign aid.
All right, we've got time for one final round of questions. So anyone hasn't asked a question yet? Yes, so what?
Yes, I was just interested. I was wondering why the survey hasn't focused, or probably it hasn't, I haven't grabbed it, hasn't focused on, in the insecurity section, on this agreement between, security agreement between Afghanistan and US that currently has a lawyer journal. And in the political transition, or probably in the women transition, why it hasn't focused on how do women feel about the peace negotiations and the reconciliation with the Taliban? Do they fear the Taliban being a couple of seats in the parliament, or how do they feel about this? I think these things were missing, so if you have your comments.
Just here first.
Considering the recent measure of active workers, and the fact that ACTIV is one of the most grassroots and well-accepted organisations in Afghanistan, I think I congratulate the Senator on raising the issue of military involvement in aid. And could you specifically tell us if you considered alternatives to that and what the drivers of that were?
Yes. A couple more questions. There were two more questions and then we'll go to the end.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm from Bangladesh. I'm a central banker in my country. My country case is not Afghanistan, but recently it is threatened because of Taliban. Why? Jamaat Islami of Bangladesh, it's in 1971, they didn't give us independence. And sir, my question is the democratic process, okay? Our present government has a lot of development, and during last 2 decades, we have done our GDP growth rate is 6%. So Bangladesh is moving towards development, okay? And our young generation, positive-minded, who are working through globalization, and particularly a lot of contribution has taken by our R&D sector. But the Taliban, and they are a leading school of thought, the fanatic forces in the country of Bangladesh. That's why Women Only Development Policy in 2011 couldn't be implemented, because still we are under the Sharia law in case of property inheritance, another is the marriage. Okay, and another thing is that if Afghanistan's situation is continuously empiring, it will create a lot of disturbances to the neighboring countries, particularly in my country context, because you are saying about the democratization. If the democratic, our next election will be held most probably in January to February, if the next government come in power, and they will be backed by these religious forces. So which development Bangladesh has done during the last 2 decades? And World Bank is estimating that within 5 to 10 years, we are going to be a middle-income country. All our development will be ended. And we have to go back to that Ahmed Zahidi, thousands of years ago. So who do you have any plan to counter these fanatic forces, particularly the Taliban? Because they are not creating problem only in Afghanistan. They are also creating the problem in other neighboring countries, particularly my country, Bangladesh. Thank you.
Thank you. Last question.
Thank you. My name is Leon Rahimi. I am from Afghanistan. I arrived in September from Kabul. I have one question for Senator, which is again relating to this question of aid and instrument of military objectives in Afghanistan. This was a hugely controversial issue in Afghanistan, for in a sense, in Uluzgan, because there was insurgency going on. There was a lot of aid also, actually, and neighboring influence and by community. There also is the part of the Uluzgan, who did a track mention aid. And I was wondering if that is going to be changing in Australian aid in the future. I know there's going to be some substantial commitment to Uluzgan province as such, but it's also going to be an increase to aid to the national budget. And the other questions I have is about the Asia Foundation, from the Asia Foundation College. I'm trying to make a sense of the contributions which are coming out of these figures. For instance, we have got 57% of people thinking the country is going in the right direction, but at the same time, reconstruction is coming as one of the main reasons. At the same time, we see that a lot of reconstruction projects are declining, and some of the big ones have already ceased or but they're not being at the same time. And the number for of confidence for ANA in national police, very high, but at the same time, there are other reports which show police being the most corrupt institution in the country. And I was wondering if you try to make some sense of this for us, and also how would you compare this in other countries like Afghanistan, that kind of confidence in the national police and national army.
28% and 10%. All right, so we'll just have to keep your responses brief and ask Senator Ellison to start. That's all right.
Well, this question of the association of the military with AusAid programs is obviously important. But the Australian military are withdrawing from Afghanistan, but our aid programs will be continued. So there shouldn't be confusion about whether the presence of the military means that a program is done for political and military purposes rather than humanitarian purposes, but I think we'll have to see how that works out, really. I'm hopeful that it will work out successfully, but we'll have to wait and see. Obviously, as was said, the Taliban are still there, and they're around the region, and I think dealing with the Taliban in reality is going to be quite a difficult problem across that whole region, and they will cause problems and mean that policy decisions will have to be made about the way various services are delivered to take into account their activities, I suspect.
Who'd like to go next?
Somebody had asked a question why we didn't ask your opinion about the BSA, the bilateral security agreement, which is still pending between the United States and Afghanistan. When we did the survey last summer, we formulated the questions last spring. So it wasn't included for that reason. The other thing, I think you had asked about what women think about reconciliation or peace talks with the Taliban. We did ask that question, so the response is in there. There were a couple of questions. One was, are you aware of and do you support the government's reconciliation efforts? And the response was 64% did, but you can break that down by province and by women's response, how many women support it. And for those women who said that they... we had another question, do you have any sympathy for the armed opposition, i.e. the Taliban? You can get the responses on that by women and men as well, which I think you'll find really interesting.
Women seem to be more likely to have no sympathy.
Go figure. I think there was another question regarding, we get this every year, we've seen the increase in people thinking the country's going in the right direction despite some of these other negative responses, and Keith, I'm going to let you field that because we've been doing a lot of thinking about that.
Oh, okay. Well, right direction, as we've already mentioned in the presentation, is based on a very practical set of issues, education, security, and so on. You could look at it the other way around, you know, 43% of people, 43% of people feel it's going in the wrong direction, and the reasons for that. But overall, I think it sounds fairly positive, but you've got to think of it in the Afghan mindset, which is very practical factors that affect their daily lives. But I would like to work on this challenge just to come back to the ANA, ANP thing, since we don't have much time. That's an interesting one, a lot of high level of confidence in those two institutions. And when we've done some thinking, there's a lot of variation at provincial level. Got for the ANP, Afghan National Police, ranges from 25% to 94% levels of confidence. So we've got to think about the data on that. What we're quoting mostly are the national level averages. Second point is that you've got ethnic differences, urban rural differences, but the main thing here is that they exist in the first place. Remember that historically, not so long ago, we didn't have these functional institutions. So people are quite positive about them. We don't have much time, so I'll shut up.
Very interesting. Okay, last response from...
Yeah, also, I had a point about the security agreement, but because of time constraint, I didn't add it. In terms of the public perceptions, because the national mood can be dramatically impacted by major national events in Afghanistan, especially what's happening now in Afghanistan because of this the bilateral security agreement between the Afghan government and the U.S. It seems that there is negative perception that impacted on the market, trade, imports. And the finance minister a week ago reported about the situation. And one of the issues with this survey is that it could miss or it misses the fluctuation in year while there is major events are happening, the association between national mood, because the perception is eventually changing whenever there is like major events taking place in Afghanistan. In terms of the Taliban, one of the issue in Afghanistan is that Afghanistan has changed a lot, especially the new generation. We got about 10 million young people going to school. It's like generation transformation in Afghanistan. I don't think so if the Taliban can come back and rule the country, perhaps they can come as players to be part of the system, but it has changed a lot. Of course, they will be like a threat to the system, and Afghanistan can offer lots of lessons to other countries as well.
All right. Well, look, we are out of time. I'd just like to close proceedings by thanking the Asia Foundation for offering to come here and coming here, of course, to launch your report. And I'd like to thank Senator Eggleston for presenting his report. And I'll only add that we are looking forward to the government's response to your report as well. And I'd like to invite you all, if you've got time, to come outside, have a cup of instant tea or instant coffee, and free biscuits. So please join with me in thanking.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.